That's John Coltrane with Equinox, McCoy Tyner on piano, Elvin Jones on drums, and Steve Davis on bass. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It's Friday, August the 9th, and at the rate things are going, the United States will have few, if any, diplomatic outposts in the Muslim world that are open for business. The State Department has ordered all but emergency personnel to leave the consulate in Lahore, Pakistan, because of a supposed terrorist threat, and warned Americans not to travel there. Earlier this week, as you know, 19 U.S. diplomatic outposts in 16 countries in the Middle East and Africa were closed to the public all the way through Saturday past, and non-essential personnel were evacuated from the U.S. embassy in Yemen after U.S. intelligence officials said they had intercepted a recent message from al-Qaeda's top leader about plans for a major terror attack. None of the consulates in Pakistan or the U.S. embassy in Islamabad were affected by the earlier closures. Well, we're going to be taking a look at a question today. Who's policing the police? Two recent cases highlight the long-standing separate and unequal treatment African Americans and Latinos experience at the conjoined hands of law enforcement and the criminal justice system. In the Bronx, a grand jury on Wednesday found no reason to reinstate charges against a plainclothes police officer who on February the 2nd last year chased 18-year-old Ramarley Graham from the street, not far from his house, into the bathroom of his house, and shot him to death there, believing, the officer said, that Graham was armed when in fact he was not. And this past Tuesday, an 18-year-old named Israel Hernandez Yach was caught spray painting graffiti on an abandoned McDonald's building in Miami Beach. Friends of the young man said officers high-fived each other and were joking and laughing after one of them fired a stun gun into his chest and brought him down. Within an hour, he was dead. Federal authorities have said that they will be reviewing both cases, but the community is tired of asking, who's policing the police? And what would it take before, in communities all across the country, what would it take before they just simply explode with the recurring theme here of young people being shot or in other ways taken out of this world by brute force of the police? And we hear these strange outcomes that, well, we put it before the grand jury, and the grand jury just decided, well, they saw no reason to indict. Let's take a look at the first case. The first case occurred, as I said, on February the 2nd, just last year. Four police officers, at least the police commissioner at least agreed with that, four police officers were stationed in the Bronx, in the Wakefield section of the Bronx, and they were supposedly casing out a bodega, a corner store, that was supposed to be the hub of local drug sales and drug transactions. And they were supposedly doing undercover work putting the bodega under constant watch. Romali Grimm was 18 at the time and living literally just up the street, on the same street as this bodega. And he was seen walking in the area. And according to police reports, he was fidgeting with his waistband. This is what they said. He was fidgeting. And one police officer decided to pursue Romali Grimm. The police officer's name is Richard Haste, H-A-S-T-E, and there's a very significant thing about his name, wouldn't you say? Richard Haste, remember, they're all in plain clothes, starts pursuing Romali. And this was, by the way, at the time, the stop and frisk procedures that the police were implementing all across the city of New York, which we now know to have been race-based. And we also know that it was a very aggressive program that was also called into question on the basis of constitutional rights violations. We don't know yet on what basis Officer Haste decided to pursue Romali Grimm. But Romali Grimm quickly believed that he was in danger of being arrested for something, and he starts running in the direction of his house, which is right up the street. And he runs into the house. The police officer is right behind him, going through the front door of the house, and Romali runs up to the apartment that he shared with the grandmother and was in the bathroom. He went into the bathroom, and the police officer follows him, chases him into the bathroom, and shoots him right there in the bathroom. The police officer's explanation was that he thought, based on feedback that he had gotten from his radio, that from his fellow officers, that Romali Grimm had a gun. But of course, it turned out he did not have a gun. And so the case sparked a great deal of outrage, of course. We've seen these kinds of cases way too often in the community, lots and lots of times, many, many times. The case went before a grand jury in the Bronx. And as we talked about, the grand jury is a process by which a prosecutor presents evidence, supposedly, that links a suspect to a crime. It is not in any way a judgment as to guilt or innocence. It simply establishes a link between someone suspected of committing a crime and the evidence that suggests that the person that they have as a suspect should also now be the defendant, because there's reasonable evidence to establish a link between the suspect and the crime. The case was presented to a Bronx grand jury, and then the grand jury did return a manslaughter charge. But the lawyers for the police officer filed, they appealed that grand jury ruling, the grand jury finding that the officer should be charged with manslaughter. And the judge, a judge hearing the case, the appeal by the lawyers, decided that, in fact, the officers, the prosecutor in the case, the Bronx DA's office, was wrong to have said to the grand jury in their deliberations that they should discount the piece of evidence that said that officers outside, this is before the officers communicating now with Officer Haste, who had told them that they think that Graham had a gun, that the prosecutor was wrong to tell the grand jury deliberating on these charges to discount that. So the indictment was thrown out on those grounds, leaving the possibility, just the same, for re-indictment. So the Bronx District Attorney re-indicted or attempted to re-indict by presenting the case once again to another grand jury. And it is that grand jury that found that there, in fact, was no reason to indict the officer, that they could not link the officer with the so-called evidence presented by the district attorney. Well, we don't know whether yet another attempt would be made, but it's said that the federal government now is now looking, you know how the cycle goes. When things fail within the state's purview via indictment and trial, then something comes up with the federal government saying, well, maybe the feds could now look into it and see whether the officer could be charged for civil rights violations. But for all intents and purposes, this case has run its course on the state level. Now, I wasn't in the court of, I was not in the grand jury proceeding. It's a secret matter. And we don't know what the prosecutor presented or did not present to influence the outcome of this grand jury proceeding. But I've been around long enough to know that there are ways in which juries can be persuaded. I don't want to presume that the police in any way influenced the jury, and I don't want to presume that the Bronx District Attorney's Office did a really lousy job of presenting this case. But it seems to me that the circumstances as they were there should have been some question raised about the fact that the officer chased the young man in the first place. Why was the chase on? What triggered it? And is it legal for police? A young man is running. He's running away from you, which is his right, actually. A young man, nobody has the obligation to just stand there if they feel that they are in danger. And I've told you stories about the Bronx, and outrageous case I've told you about in the Bronx was that of Larry Davis and the young men like him who were actually rounded up by police and made. Larry Davis was actually running a gun sales prostitution ring and a drug business for the cops. So Romali Graham is running away, and he's running into his home. The question now is, was the police officer correct? Was it correct for that police officer to run into his house. And by the way, the others that came behind him, three others that came behind him, broke down the door and entered his apartment. They just broke down the door, entered his apartment. The police officer, Mr. Haste, Officer Haste, corners him in the bathroom and shoots him dead there in his house. Now that sounds really outrageous. Let's say that the police officer believed on the street that there was some reason to chase this young man, for what we don't know. But did that reason extend all the way into his house? And do we have a different kind of rule that goes along when you're dealing with people who are African-American? You imagine that a police officer would chase anybody, say, on Park Avenue? And if they did chase him, but the person entered their doorman building and went up to the multi-million-dollar, multi-room apartment, very luxurious apartment, that the police officers would break down their door, just kick it in and run in there and find you in your bathroom and shoot you in your bathroom. And the reason is always the same. The officer thought his life was in danger, and he thought Romali Graham had a gun. Amazing. But not really. Because we know these cases by heart. These cases pop up all the time. I remember telling you about a case in February the 4th in 1999. A 23-year-old man was just coming home, and a plainclothes officer decided he and his cohorts, four of them, I think, should follow this man. The man panics. There's no reason for anybody to be following him and making him feel that his life was in danger. He's trying to get into his house. And 41 bullets later, the officers said that they had to shoot because they felt their lives were in danger. That man was Amadou Diallo. So we have a question. Who is policing the police here? And why is it that we go through these cycles time and again? And why should the expectation be that people will not lose patience and they will continue to trust in the system to do the right thing and deliver justice in these cases? That the community could absorb this kind of treatment over and over and over again, and their children are dying. Fathers are dying, brothers are dying, simply for that terse statement that is made in the aftermath that departmental regulations are being reviewed, and we believe that this situation points up a need for some administrative improvement somewhere. But the administrative improvement always comes at the expense of somebody's life. At some point, there's going to be a serious eruption of violent reaction over this because people are fed up of it. Fed up of it. And they're disgusted with the fact that we have no real answers and we have only these platitudes and the, you know, the compulsory speeches that are made. We are investigating and we're looking to see whether with the criminal justice system having failed completely at the state level, we're trying to see whether we can salvage something by having the feds come in. And the best that the feds could do is to see whether civil rights were violated. Well, I would say so. We have a dead person. How's that? We could start there about the civil rights. The person is dead. On Tuesday, in Miami Beach, an 18-year-old, just like in the Bronx, an 18 is the magic year, apparently. He had just graduated from high school, and he was known in the community among his friends, and he had done a couple of art shows and so forth, but he was known as a graffiti person, graffiti artist. But the officers rolled up as he was spray painting on an old McDonald's store, restaurant, that was no longer in use. It was shuttered and abandoned. And according to friends of the young man, Israel Hernandez Yach was his name, according to his friends, the police decided that the best way to deter him from doing that or even arresting him was to fire into his chest a stun gun, and he, of course, collapsed. And they were so pleased with their performance, they were high-fiving each other and having a big laugh about the fact that they had several of them, by the way. This is one individual, and several of them decided that this was the best way to arrest the situation. Within an hour, Israel was dead. And we're hearing reports that even an hour later, his internal body temperature exceeded 103 degrees. At most, the young man would have been charged. I mean, if he really wanted to follow the letter of the law, at most he would have been charged with a second-degree misdemeanor, according to a lawyer who is representing the family. At most, it would be that charge for defacing property, let's say, with graffiti. Well, what do we know about graffiti? I mean, about the laser stun gun. According to the ACLU, the Civil Liberties Union, between 2001 and 2012, just last year, more than 500 people in the United States were killed by stun guns used by law enforcement officers. They deliver as much as sometimes 50,000 volts. A body can't withstand that. It causes cardiac arrest. And they know that tasers are lethal weapons. This is not a joke. This is not to temporarily immobilize anyone. It causes death. More than 500 people have been killed this way, and clearly the law enforcement community must know that this is something that they have to reconsider. If a taser is to be used, you might as well shoot, because it could be that lethal. And what would possibly be the reason that all these officers, with this young man so outnumbered, he clearly had no weapon. With all these officers so far outnumbering this one individual, that they could not in any way arrest him in a different way that would have respected his right to life. But this same police department in North Miami Beach, 2 years ago, had been held responsible, officers from that same department, fired 116 shots 2 years ago at a young Haitian man who was participating in the annual hip-hop festival and apparently had too much to drink and was driving somewhat erratically down the street. And the price he paid for being allegedly, we still don't know, allegedly tipsy, allegedly drunk, behind the wheel, was 116 bullets fired at him after his car had stopped. 16 of the bullets hit their mark. And that was 2 years ago. Not only was he killed, his name is Raymond Harris, not only was he killed, but four other bystanders. By the way, this is all happening with a huge crowd. This is an event that is attended by a large crowd. The cops are shooting indiscriminately. But 116 shots were fired by the officers from the same police department, as well as officers from the Hialeah Police Department, which is a town not too far away from North Miami Beach. So what is this saying? That case, by the way, still has not come to trial. The officers in that case 2 years ago, still have not given a statement to the prosecutor. They still have not yet been questioned about this event 2 years ago, let alone this case coming to trial. These are some of the examples that we have about the flagrant violation of people's rights and the fact that the police are becoming not at all unlike, you know, the lawless people that they say they're there to protect the community from. They're acting like gangsters. And they have, in too many ways, the protection of the system that is supposed to assure the public, who, by the way, are paying for the service of law enforcement, for their safety and security. This is what is going on. This never, ever, really, you never hear cases like these occurring in white communities, in wealthy communities. You never hear this kind of thing happening, this kind of barbaric behavior. It never happens. What could possibly be the reason for firing 116 bullets at anybody? And still, 2 years down the road, they have not yet made themselves available for questioning. What does that say? Are they asking? Is the law enforcement community asking for all-out war? Is that what they want? They want, you know, you bring your gun, I bring my gun, and let's fight. Let's fight, you know, let's see who can outshoot who. Is that what they want? A kind of okay corral kind of shootout? Do they want people to just lose it after a point and just say, you know, the heck with it? When a parent sees a child being dispatched from life in this violent way and believes there's nothing to lose, can you really, in the face of this pattern, tell people to trust in the system, trust that things will go on right, trust that they will take care of things, trust that, you know, the officers doing these atrocious things will be brought to justice? These people don't have feelings for their children either. They don't want their children to live too. They don't have the same kind of parental love for their children that other people do. But that's where things are going. When the police and the law enforcement community, by their overt, this is not even tacit approval, this is their overt approval, when they overtly approve of these clear-cut disparities and the clear-cut injustices, what they are saying to people is, at some point, you will end up having to do what you think you have to do. If the system cannot discernibly deliver justice, are they not provoking people to exact justice in whatever way they choose, whatever way they believe will work? And when do we end the cycle of white police officers attacking black and Latino young men, especially this way? When do we end that cycle? When does it occur to this large system that there's a problem there? And it's been talked about time and time and time again. I'm sick of it. It is textbook. It's just plain textbook examples now. Police do something, immediately it's, well, I was afraid for my life. He made very funny moves. He was fidgeting. They said he was fidgeting with his waistband. Well, so people aren't supposed to fidget with your waistband when they see a plainclothes person. Don't fidget with your waistband. It could cost you your life. And that's who we have patrolling our communities. Something has got to give. What is it? Well, I believe one thing should happen right away. I think there should be, for police officers, they should be compelled to take out their own insurance. They should be compelled to insure themselves, especially those who have had a history of doing really unorthodox things and illegal things. If they're not kicked off the force, which is really what they shouldn't even be on the force. Take out your own insurance and see what happens. These police officers run like renegades in the community. And people think that there's some kind of a natural rebellion, some kind of a genetically coded way of young people behaving that they hate the cops. No, they hate injustice. The communities hate it. Hate injustice. And when the system at every single level is either unwilling or unable to deliver it, when these cycles, enough of these cycles have been experienced over a long period of time, and I suggest to you that that long period of time has, you know, run its course, at some point soon, if this is not a high priority item at a local, state, and national level, then there will be no way to turn back the anger that will express itself in what people will consider to be extreme ways. Because you will not be able to tell people any longer with any degree of credibility that, yes, these situations occur and they can't all be the case. It can't all be the case that people are wrong when they say, look, the guy didn't have a gun. Well, I thought he had a gun. Well, yes, you thought you had a gun, but simply because you're a police officer doesn't give you the right to think somebody has a gun and take their life and then be wrong. You cannot bring people back. What do you say? Oops. If the tables were turned, and let's say the police officer Haste had a son or a daughter, and somebody blew that child away because they thought the child had a gun, and would they tolerate that as a rational answer? Let alone from a police officer who's supposed to be professionally trained. This is why all these millions of dollars are spent to have these police academies to train these people. And this is why we need to see a sensitivity training and all of that, and a presence, a cultural match. You have all this in the mix, all these years of racial conditioning, and a deep-seated, perhaps even expressed when they're among themselves, a loathing for the communities that they are. They feel that they don't need to be there. They like the money they're making. They just hate the people. They hate the community. We'll take this break. And when I come back, I want to talk about Mr. Obama right after this. This is Eutrice Lead. You're listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM. Well, now we know what the topic of discussion might have been when Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama had lunch on July the 29th. Among the topics that they probably discussed over lunch. By the way, you notice that the lunch was held outside. Yeah, well, they don't need anybody spying on them. But one of the things that might have come up, of course, was the matter of the presidential Medal of Freedom, which the President Obama intends to confer on the good old President Bill. You know, it just never stops. But just when you think Barack Obama has some degree of self-respect left, he comes up with this kind of stuff, which is so blatantly political. Bill Clinton, as opposed to, let's say, George Bush, Bill Clinton, in the eyes of President Obama, has done a great deal in terms of his philanthropy and his his generosity and all of that stuff, and his promotion of health issues and so forth overseas. He rates a Presidential Medal of Freedom. Now, we're going to set aside for the moment, of course, we'll have selective memory going here. We'll set aside for the moment that this was a president who also, about who articles of impeachment had been voted. This is the lying president who is now fully rehabilitated, of course. There's no reason. The guys are just fantastic. But really what it is, and it's a cynical thing, and this is, again, politics. The president, of course, has no, I mean, I can't expect anything lower from Barack Obama. I mean, he's just not thinking right. He is a managed president. These are the things that happen. How people rehabilitate themselves. Bill Clinton will be fully rehabilitated once he gets this Presidential Medal of Freedom. Not that he wasn't before. The media have conveniently set it aside. They know they would never, ever refer to him as, you know, here's the lying sex predator president. They'll never refer to him as that. He is a fully rehabilitated man, you know, given more or less to the foibles of the flesh. But besides that, he's just fantastic. No funny stuff. You know, Whitewater, all those investigations and so forth, set those aside. But that is the way that it is done to clear the path for Bill Clinton to basically bring Hillary Clinton into the realm of, how should I call it, the realm of credibility. It will extend. Whatever is given to Bill will extend to Hillary Clinton should she decide to run. And frankly, I don't care at this point whether I'm not worrying, is she running or she? We'll just know. Whenever the time comes, we'll know whether she's running or not. I'm not one fascinated by the, you know, obsessed with the prognostication. Is she going to run? Is she not? I don't care about that. If she wants to run, it's a free country. She could run. But I will tell you, this is how it's done. So Bill Clinton would have received the Presidential Medal of Freedom, and it proves, of course, the subservience of Barack Obama to the Clintons. For what reason, I have no idea. But he very, very slavishly is loyal to them, and for what reason, I don't know. But this is how it's done. The stench associated, as we see with Anthony Weiner and with Elliot Spitzer, you notice that is not at all associated with Bill Clinton. The fact that he literally just dishonored the very office that is issuing the Presidential Medal of Freedom is just a moot point. It doesn't surface at all. And he is in the company now, Bill, of real bona fide, serious-minded, real people with some degree of moral character, which he does not have. And Mrs. Clinton will now be the person. Remember, she was the co-president. She was a co-president with Bill Clinton for all those years. She will now be the co-receiver of the Presidential Medal of Freedom, the highest honor conferred on American citizens is conferred on a person who absolutely disgraced the office that he occupied. Isn't that interesting? Barack Obama, I'm told, may very well end up addressing this march that is to be held, as they call it, to commemorate the 50th anniversary of the March for Freedom and Jobs, for Jobs and Freedom. And it's a sad, sad state of affairs because I see I've gone over the preliminary list of people who are going to be there to address the crowd, and they include the likes of Nancy Pelosi and, all the Democratic people who need to be washed in the eyes of the public, especially among African Americans who have a knack for always being emotional at the wrong time and who are unable to be very objective about who is their friend and who is not, and who is a leader, who is a genuine leader, and who is not. But they will assemble themselves and anoint themselves as the natural inheritors of Martin Luther King's dream. And it really wasn't Martin Luther King's dream. This is the thing. It was grassroots organizing. People like Bayard Rustin, people like A. Philip Randolph, people like Cleveland Robinson, a whole bunch of folks. Grassroots, genuine grassroots leadership with a long history of involvement in their communities, a long history of struggle, a long history of integrity with their struggle. And we will see this turn into a spectacle of people who can't even shine Dr. King's shoes. They will anoint themselves as leaders, the rightful leaders, and they will in turn anoint others, and it's all pure politics. There's no integrity in leadership. It's all pure politics. We're going to call a march, and therefore, because we call it, it means we own it. And they actually do it. We own the march. This is our personal march. We are in the event planning business now. They're not ever going to sit in a room with Barack Obama and say, listen here, mister, this is what you're going to do. They're not going to have that kind of knockdown, drag out fight with the president. They are all accommodationists. Every single one of these leaders that they want the community to accept. Nancy Pelosi, who Barack Obama personally has said it is his personal mission to return her to the leadership of the House. Of course, she was ordained by God to have that office for the rest of her life. This multi-millionaire woman who is as dedicated to black progress as apparently Mr. Obama is. They're going to come before the folks and they will all hold hands and they will all sing, we shall overcome. When in fact, I think we should change the name of that. It is also we shall overcome. We are overcome. We are overcome by unemployment. We are overcome by lack of education. We are overcome by lack of housing, we are overcome, period. We are overcome. Now get up there. All these political hacks, these deceivers who don't have the slightest intention of changing fundamentally and structurally the oppression that people are experiencing. They want it because it's a moment and their face could be associated with it, and they're going to take that and run it as part of their election propaganda, and silly, silly people will say, oh, they love us. We might as well return the favor and vote for them. It is the height of cynicism. And I keep reminding communities, all communities, everybody needs to get serious about who the leader is and who they're not. And when a leader just cannot measure up, you make a public announcement. You cancel their contracts publicly. From this day forward, we want everyone to know we no longer recognize this person as having any legitimate role to play in representing our interests. This person does not speak for us. This person does not know us, and we do not recognize this person. All the time that Nancy Pelosi has been there, in a leadership capacity, why do we have these conditions that we have? All the time that this president has been in office, why do we have the conditions that we have? But they continue to defile their communities. They open up their churches on a Sunday to have these miscreants show up. Even in a place of worship, we're not immune to their deception. They come in there and they talk their nonsense and everybody applauds and they go like sheep and they vote. And they say, yes, well, you know, she is a really, Bill Clinton is a wonderful, oh my God, I just love him. He's such a great guy. Look at Haiti and tell me he's a great guy. All the suffering that has gone on and continued by this president, and I reminded you just this week, it was 790 days before he actually decided to meet with members of the Congressional Black Caucus, who represent the distressed communities all across America. 790 days. And this man is probably going to be one of the big speakers. Look at me, I'm at the mall. This is a historic occasion. 50 years have gone by and here I am. I missed Martin, but you know, this is the next best thing. I'm standing next to Martin Luther King III, and we shall overcome. And he's going to talk black as much as he can. He's going to talk black. Yeah. And everybody's going to hold hands, and we're all going to sing, "We Shall Overcome." And America will once again be a just country where we're all on the same playing field and we can all pursue happiness and full employment together. They know they should keep in mind there was a point when black folks had no employment problems. We were fully employed. It's called slavery. There was no unemployment problem then. And that's exactly where they're hoping that we would end up once again. Full employment. Bring that back. Bring slavery back. Look, I tell you, if it weren't so dismal, it would almost be funny. But of course, you know, it's not funny. It is not funny. And what is about to happen at the end of the month when they hold this great march is a sick kind of joke. And it is purely politically motivated. There is no grassroots agenda. There is no sense of asking people what the priorities are. It is all about, look at me. I'm the new flavor in town. I could make this happen, and it's good coverage. You know the television, the warmth of the television lights will be there. I would have made history being there, and it is all about the preamble to the next level of deceit to maintain loyalty of the black community, especially for the upcoming election cycle. And that's all it is. That's all it is. Because black folks don't need much. They settle for so little. We throw them a good march and we're all right. So we talked about two things today. I want you to think about them over the weekend, because when we get to our open phones next Tuesday, we'll have some things to offer and debate. In the meantime, have a decent weekend, relax a little bit, and don't carry this burden, this mental burden, with you all weekend. It's important to discuss it, but it is not supposed to oppress you. It is supposed to enlighten you and make you think. And we'll connect with each other. I want you, though, to be part of the effort to grow PRN.FM and to grow this particular program as well. Let people know this is where you tune in at 1 o'clock for some good talk. Okay? Take care.